All right, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to SaberSims DFS Office Hours. It is Tuesday, May 17th of 2022. Thanks for tuning in here today. My name's Jordan. I'm the head coach here at SaberSim, and Office Hours is an open Q&A style show where I answer questions from the SaberSim community about SaberSim, about DFS, whatever you guys want to talk about. Your questions drive the conversation that we have here on this show. If you have questions that you would like me to answer on Office Hours, you can email us support@sabersim.com. You can type your questions into chat if you are watching me here live. And of course, you can post your questions in the Office Hours channel in Slack. If you are not already a part of our Slack community, there's a link to join Slack in the description of every past show, both on YouTube and on the podcast versions of this show, which are now up on pretty much all major podcast hosting networks and also a handful of minor podcast hosting networks, a couple that I had never even heard of. So we're all set up there. Of course, in the description of every past show is also a timestamped list of everything we talked about. So if you're watching or listening to the recording and want to bounce around a little bit, you absolutely can do so. Should be a fun one here for us today. We'll talk a little bit more about some research build stuff. Been a pretty common thread here on our shows recently. We'll talk a little bit about some NBA Showdown, continuing to do some NBA playoff, NBA Showdown kinds of conversations here. We'll talk a little bit about, let's see, what else do we have here? How long it takes to kind of, not even so much backtest, I guess maybe backtest, but how long it takes, how much runway you need to know whether your process is working. And I think that's a really interesting question. Excited to dive into that. And then we'll go from there and see what we get to from there. But let's go ahead. Let's get our app pulled up and get started here. And I'm actually going to start here with NBA Showdown. So let's go ahead and dive into this here. And we'll start with a question from Phantom. And his question says, with NBA's better contest now shifting to single game and showdown, what would be your strategies for attacking slates, keeping potential for duplication in mind and how a lot of guys are getting high minutes? So let's bounce over to NBA Showdown and talk a little bit about this here. So we do have the classic slates, the Tuesday to Wednesday two-game slate here this week. But I do believe that the bigger, the marquee, the flagship contests are for these single games now. So let's talk about this a little bit here. I will say one thing. So we did make an update to our NBA model earlier this month that allows, the best way I would describe it is it allows our NBA model to be a little bit more agile during the playoffs. I think it's not something that's flashy. It won't necessarily jump off the page, but I do think it's a really valuable adjustment in that it will pick up on, you know, changes to rotations, minutes, usage, that kind of thing a little bit more quickly, just because one of the things that's unique about NBA playoffs in particular is we have to work with pretty small sample sizes, right? Even though the same team's going to play each other for sometimes seven games in a row, right? The coaches are switching things up. We'll have situations where, you know, rotations are different. Sometimes players are getting hurt. You know, if a player is getting hot or a matchup is working right, then maybe the coach will stay with it. And our model now will pick up on these kinds of things a little bit more quickly. And I think that can be quite a high value add. In terms of strategy, I wouldn't say that I am massively differentiating my approach to how I'm tackling these slates here, just because of where we're at in the playoffs now, or just because we're in the playoffs. The most important thing to me in the way that I strategically like to attack NBA Showdown is still from the standpoint of getting to a unique lineup, both from the standpoint of, you know, avoiding duplication, right? Actually literally building a unique lineup, but also, you know, playing a little bit more of an exploitative game, trying to be a little bit more contrarian, trying to do something that the field isn't going to do. And a lot of times that ends up mostly being done with the way that I think about my lineup construction, and the way that I think about my captain spot. I think those are two really good ways to differentiate and get a little bit more unique. So a lot of times what I'll do, I'll get an idea of, you know, what does the field think the game is going to play like? And in this case, it looks like kind of, you know, based on Vegas totals and the SaberSim totals even, you know, looks like probably assuming a pretty close game here, kind of a defensive battle. At least between the Celtics and Heat in game one here tonight. So I will build some lineups And let's say we're just building for a 20 max. And I think the important thing to remember here, and I always want to reinforce this point because I just think it's so important when you're doing anything with SaberSim, is to remember that what you have when you build lineups is you have optimals for actual game simulations of the way that this game could play out, right? At Sim Variance 10, we are taking a single game simulation, right, from our base of simulations here, and building the optimal lineup for that particular sim. This is essentially doing that alone, figuring out how can this game play out, what are the different game scripts of how this game could play out, and what are the optimals represented by that game script, would take so much work, would be almost an entire NBA showdown process on any other tool out there. That is what is already being optimized for you here just when you first press build. And we have 500 of them here. And I think the field that is trying to do that in a more like intuitive way, they're trying to, you know, just step through the parts of that process to get to those lineups, is going to do it in a way that naturally incorporates a ton of bias into that process, right? The field is going to assume that the range of outcomes of the way that a game could play out are far more narrow than the way they could actually play out. They're going to assume that there's probably a much more limited pool of viable captains than there actually is. And that is the kind of thing that I like to exploit when I'm building NBA Showdown lineups. In these contests now, as we approach the end of the season here, that are going to be really big, I am more just trying to be even more aggressive with that. I'm trying to leverage even more because as the contests get bigger, there's more and more entrants. We need to differentiate ourselves even further. So on a slate like tonight, for example, if we have a close spread, low scoring game, one of the things that I would probably be pretty excited to do is to just force roster constructions here, or to at least see what is the viability of roster constructions that assume that this game does not play out very closely, right? What does it look like when it's a Celtics or a Heat blowout? Right. And maybe one of those situations. And when I say testing viability, right, one of the ways you can do that is just force roster constructions with maybe five stacks. Right. What do uneven stacks of this game look like? And you can see right off the bat, we weren't getting any five stacks in our first pool of 20. But if we set our min exposure to 100 for five stacks, right, we'll see immediately that there are a ton of viable lineups in this pool. Again, all based on optimals from individual game sims where we have five stacks. And I think in a close spread, the field is unlikely to build roster constructions that have this kind of structure, I guess, is what I'm trying to say here, right? Another thing I like to do is look at those captains. And play captains that differentiate you from the field. I think it's probably very likely that Jimmy Butler, the stars of this game, right, the people that you know turn the game on and want to watch play, are going to be probably a little bit overowned. We have a 33.5% captain ownership for Jimmy Butler at the moment, right? X that out and get exposure to some of these captains that it will be difficult for the field to see their path to success, but we have these game simulations that back up the viability there, right? Also, sometimes I'm a little bit careful. Actually, no, I was going to say, sometimes I'm a little bit careful of captains that pop because of a high point per dollar value, but we don't really have that happening here. And just doing that, I think, is a really good way to differentiate. I might even X out a guy like Jason Tatum, who I think could also be a popular captain, and differentiate that way. I think there is if you are really staying tuned in to how these games are playing out, I think especially as the series goes on and as teams have a little bit more, I don't want to say more to play for because every team has a ton to play for in the conference finals here. But I also don't think game one is going to be the situation where you'll see guys get pushed to 44 minutes or something like that. But as the series plays out, if you're watching these games, following these games along, I do think you can spend a little bit of time studying the minutes projections and making sure that they are in line with what you think intuitively is going to happen, particularly as teams start to face elimination games as we have a little bit more of the data as the series goes along. That is the kind of thing that update to our model that we pushed out earlier this month should account for. But I think that can be another good way to add value. I don't know if I'm going to be rushing to make adjustments from a minute standpoint in game one of a series or game two of these series here. But as they go along, studying rotations on Popcorn Machine or on some of these other tools out there and making sure that the minutes projections are kind of in line with the way that these teams are actually playing, I think could be another good way to add value. But my approach in NBA Showdown remains what it has been all season, and just is even more so to that effect now that we are in these really big contests at the end of the season. I want to differentiate. I want to take advantage of the fact that I don't think the field is really going to truly understand the full range of outcomes of the way that the game is going to play out. I'm going to look at what is the easiest, what is the most likely outcome that the field is going to overvalue, and how am I going to leverage against that? I think you can also, get away with doing some research builds here too, if that's your thing. It gets a little weird because the research builds end up being a very similar set of sliders to your actual sliders that you're using to build your lineups. But I think if you are unsure of, what these different percent chances of being optimal are and where are these actual opportunities to run to find leverage, I think you can run these builds and see what does a 1500 set of simulations of this game actually look like. How often are certain captains in the optimal lineup? How often are certain lineup constructions optimal, and leverage a little bit more against that? I think that can be another pretty powerful approach here. And I'm curious for this game tonight here what that actually looks like. But I think at the captain spot, in particular, you'll just see ownership kind of tend to get a little bit out of control on some of these top elite plays, far outweighing their actual chance of being the optimal captain. Let's take a look. I'm curious what we actually see out here. Really good example, right? So Jimmy Butler was the first guy I'd crossed off when I was looking for leverage at the captain spot. And I do think, a 35% captain share is probably pretty reasonable for him. We're seeing he's the optimal captain 15% of the time, right? That's basically exactly what I'm trying to leverage against. The stacks can be interesting too here. It is interesting to note that the five stack only shows up as optimal 8% of the time. I think that's still a healthy chunk for trying to take down a large field GPP on a contest like this, but is a little interesting that, maybe that construction's not as viable there. Running these research builds and finding opportunities to take stands on some of these captain positions, right? And also in the other direction, too. We've got a guy, Al Horford, showing up as the optimal captain 10.5% of the time. Current ownership projection in the captain spot is only 2.25%. A guy that we just saw has pretty massive upside in the last series can absolutely be viable in that particular position. We were getting to a lot of Marcus Smart there in that test build as well. Those are the kinds of things that I'm looking for here. So similar overall, I guess that's kind of an overview of how I approach these NBA Showdown contests in general, still generally sticking to my overall same strategies here. But probably, being a little bit more aggressive with my stands, with my leverage opportunities now that the contests are going to be getting so big. But good question. Jonathan said game ones are like guessing games. Yeah, I think they can be a little bit. But I think that can be advantageous to us, here where, I would happily jump into a guessing game with the field, because I think that the tools that we have available to us here are just more powerful, right? Will give us a better idea of what the possibilities are, where everybody else is going to be kind of left having to make some assumptions. Cool. Jonathan also said, if you're playing Robert Williams, should you play less Al Horford and Grant Williams? I'm curious. So we have Robert Williams projected right now. I would assuming kind of a typical 25 minutes, somewhat typical workload, not listed with a questionable tag here. We've got a ton of Miami guys listed questionable, obviously a lot here, still to change. I would say this, When game time approaches and the final sims run and we have starting lineups and we know kind of what the state of the game is here, because you're using game sims to build these lineups, you will get, the right amount of Horford with no Robert Williams lineups in accordance with how often those are optimal. Same thing the other way. So it's probably not something that I would be worrying about too much. I would let kind of the sims take care of those individual roster construction kind of questions for me. I do. Anytime there's a narrative for why maybe the field might be scared off of a player who has been dealing with injury recently or has some murkiness to his minutes load in a game one where it's already going to be a little bit of a cloudier situation with rotations and things like that, I'm typically, you know, that's another reason for me to be more on somebody. Or, you know, if Marcus Smart's questionable tag starts scaring people away, even if he's active, that's another situation where I'd want to be on somebody too. So Jonathan said, hoping that Robert Williams is 10%, less than 10% owned on FanDuel today. I would be too. Absolutely. I am on board for that. So. Cool. Let's keep it going. Jump into another question here. So Matt asks a question about research builds here. And he said, I've been experimenting with ways to take research builds to an extra level for even more value. For example, running a default research build for stacks. If I decide to take a strong stance and fade a chalky stack, so I remove that team from my stacking rule and rerun the research build so the chalk isn't your pool at all. Same thing with a fade stance on an overowned starting pitcher, X amount, and then run another build. Thoughts on things like this, or is that going too far or not a good use of time? I actually think Tom asked a very interesting follow-up question to that. And he said, what is the goal of this process? And I would ask you that as well, Matt, here. I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that. What you will get out of that would be a research build. Essentially, it would be as if you said, assuming this stack is not the optimal stack, what are the probabilities of the remaining stacks left in the pool, right? If we say, you know, if you take the Giants out, right? Giants probably going to be the chalkiest stack again here tonight. You take the Giants out, you run another research build. That would basically say to you, here is the remaining probabilities of these teams being the optimal stack at the end of the slate, assuming that the Giants are not the optimal stack. If that information is useful to you in your process, I think those steps are a good approach to getting that answer. I've never done anything like that. I'm not sure for me personally what usefulness that would have in my process. I would prefer to study these research builds on the slate as a whole. But if you have already decided to take that stand and then maybe you want to see what are the best stacks I can get to outside of the Giants, I guess one thing that could be potentially advantageous to doing that is you would get more detailed information about what the probabilities of the other teams being the optimal stacks are, right? Like, let's say just hypothetically, let's say you run a research build and 20% of your lineups have a Giant stack in it, right? Well, if you have already decided to fade them, you are trying to judge the probabilities of the remaining teams being the optimal stack from a incomplete sample, I guess, right? Only 80% of the available lineups that are there for you to build anyway, you're judging from that. So I guess from that standpoint, that it could make some sense. But I do think it's a really good question, you know, to think what is my goal? What is the end goal I'm trying to get out of this? Anytime we're adding something to our process or doing something new, what do I want to get out of this? Right. And being able to name that specifically, the product in your process of what you get out of that. And then from there, asking some follow-up questions of, you know, is this an efficient way to get that information? Right. The answer may be yes or no, depending on what you're doing there. And then also, you know, does this actually, you know, specifically answer the question that I'm trying to solve, right? One example of that here in this particular situation is that, you know, once you've removing stacks from your research build and running a build with the remaining stacks, those actual numbers you're getting out don't really have a ton of mathematical meaning. Right. They are you've adjusted the system, you've taken things out of it, and you're running the slate tonight is never actually going to play without, unless it gets postponed, I assume, but I don't think there's any weather risks in that game. The slate tonight's never actually going to play without the Giants and Rockies game on the slate. So running a research build without them is going to give you potentially incomplete information, depending on what you're looking for. So all of this to say, I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. I would ask yourself, you know, what is the goal I'm trying to get out of this? What information am I trying to get out of this? And is it useful in my process to have that information? And if the answer is yes, I think it's a good idea. So, but I really like Tom's question there, because I think that's always an important thing. And I have to remind myself of that, right? Sometimes I get excited about certain things in my process for different sports that I just think would be almost cool to do, interesting thought experiments to run. And I end up with these kind of bloated systems where I end up having to pull things back off of it because I've added a lot. I've bloated up a process with steps that I don't really feel like I need anymore. So always good to be checking in and making sure that different steps in our process are valuable. But good question. And then Rogue 3. Asked a question here about smaller slates, batter versus pitcher. He said, is there ever a time when it's the right move to allow batters versus opposing pitchers on smaller MLB slates, 2 or 3 games max? Yeah, absolutely. I typically will turn that toggle on anytime we're talking about a 3-game slate or smaller. And in fact, that toggle should automatically turn on anytime you're talking about a 3-game slate or smaller. So I think it makes a lot of sense. Keep in mind, you typically still won't get a lot of those lineup constructions because the correlation slider is still having an effect, right? If we look at, you know, a guy like Cease, he's going to be pretty heavily negatively correlated to all of the KC bats. So if you're going to get a Cease plus, Perez lineup or something like that, Perez in that case has to his projection in that sim building that lineup has to be so good that it outweighs the net strong negative correlation that he has to Cease anyway there. So something to at least remember there. You typically don't get a lot of them anyway, but I do like the idea of turning that toggle on here, for those size slates and it turns on automatically. I think the only other thing to be aware of is that, you know, if we have like a 4-game slate with a game that gets postponed, a game that becomes a 3-game slate at the moment, our settings don't automatically adjust in a case like that. That would be a situation where you'd probably want to pay attention and make sure the sliders and settings overall match what the slate has become rather than the way it started. But yes, that toggle should automatically turn on when you're talking about a small slate. So, and then, I got another question here. We'll answer this one. And this one says, when starting to build a process, what is a reasonable time to test it out over? Not close yet, but with the Sims, I'm not sure. Would imagine if the ROI is really bad for a week, then I've tweaked too much. Sorry if this has been asked a billion times. You know, this is a tough question to answer. The actual runway that I feel like you would need to properly test a process to properly, like, prove that a process was profitable or that you are a positive EV player takes a long time, a lot longer than a week, to be completely honest. If you have the skill set to do it, I frankly don't. You can get away with doing, you know, back tests of different seasons and even multiple different simulations of different seasons and kind of prove that a process, had you played it in every single slate of a season, would have been profitable. There's holes even in that. The reality is that a lot of times I think as, you know, a typical DFS player, we have to rely a little bit on heuristics and rules of thumb to know that a process is working. One of those heuristics is top 1% equity, right? The idea of top 1% equity, and you can use something like RotoTracker. You can calculate this for yourself if you're pulling down your CSVs, but RotoTracker is a really good tool that will do this for you. Right? The idea of top 1% equity is that, you know, if we are an average player would have an expectation of putting 1% of their lineups into the top 1% of a contest, right? That would be pure average. Basically, by pure luck, the law of large numbers, over a long period of time, you would put 1% of your entries in the top 1% of a contest. Well, to be profitable, we have to beat the average and we also have to beat the rake, right? So if you are putting more than your top 1% equity, more than 1% of your lineups into the top 1%, it is a decent heuristic at saying you're probably a long-term profitable player. Other heuristics can be used in terms of dealing with things like lineup construction and ownership. We had talked about last week here some of the value of comparing what other sharp players are doing with their roster construction and ownership, right? If you study somebody like Giant Squid's baseball lineups for a handful of weeks, right? Seeing how he handles different slates from an ownership standpoint, right? How did he navigate a situation in a similar contest with a chalk last night, for example, two chalky pitchers where the rest of pitching was kind of garbage, right? How did he handle a Coors Field game where two of the teams playing in Coors were projected for a run and a half over every other team on the slate? What types of roster constructions did he use, right? What types of stacks did he use? And the reason a lot of that exists and I think can be somewhat valuable is because the reality is you need a pretty significantly sized sample to really determine if your process is positive EV over the long term. Being down over the course of a week is definitely not, I think, a fair characterization of whether a process actually works or not. I think even the course of a whole season, right, there's probably some sample size issues there. Another thing I think you can do here is it is harder to realize your expected value in a short time horizon the larger your contest, the larger your contests that you're playing are. So while playing larger contests does put you up against softer competition, and I think will increase your expected value over the long term, I think by playing smaller contests, you can get a better indication of if your process is working a little bit more quickly. I think by scaling down your bankroll a little bit, focusing on some smaller contests and seeing how those are going, you'll get a better opportunity to realize more quickly. If you're playing, the $1 minimax up against 50,000 entrants every single night, it's going to be very hard, even over the course of a season, to know if your process actually worked, just because the raw probability of being successful in super large contests is a little bit lower. So all of this to say, I think a couple things, to actually judge your EV, your profitability. I really do like looking at studying my top 1% equity, and I have a RotoTracker subscription to do that. Second, I think you can compare yourself to other sharp players. Be cautious. Not all players that have a prominent role in the DFS space are as frankly successful as they may seem, right? I think studying Giants Wits lineups can be a good use of your time. And seeing in similar contests, what is he doing with roster construction? What is he doing with similar different ownership situations, different slate contexts? And finally, scaling down into a little bit smaller contest if you want something where you can realize your edge a little bit more quickly and see if your process is actually working. So, but cool. Let's jump over to YouTube chat. Hit some questions over there. Daniel said, I'm having trouble figuring out how to use review mode. I did my first set of lineups last night. Cool. Yeah. Let's talk about this. I actually, to be completely honest, I don't actually use review mode all too often. I think it's useful for a quick glance of seeing the lineups that you actually played and seeing, what those lineups scored. I don't know if it's necessarily better than just studying the lineups in the app. That is essentially what this does, right? So if we're in a pass build and we toggle the review mode on, what it does is it takes your 20 lineups and it sorts them in order from your highest actual scoring lineups to your lowest. If you're interested in seeing, how did my lineups actually perform, right? This is just a build I had up from yesterday. I think that can be useful. I don't know if it's better than actually just going in the app and seeing and checking what the lineups actually scored. I think while it can be useful to check and study over a longer time horizon how other sharp players are comparing to what your lineups are doing, and seeing, did I make similar decisions to what other sharp players did? Was my thought process correct for this particular slate? I think I would be careful really diving in too deep to one particular slate, and especially trying to over-optimize to that particular slate, because I think what that can end up doing sometimes is just teaching you what buttons to have pressed for a slate that already happened in the past, right? I often see people go down a path of saying, okay, I'm gonna review my May 16th slate here and spend an hour on that and figure out that, if you do this and that and change this projection here and change this exposure here, that you can get your highest actual scoring lineup out of your pool and as your number one lineup. But I'm not sure how repeatable or how useful that process is in the long term. So I would actually, I think if Daniel, if you're looking for something to kind of do to review your process from a previous slate, I would ask yourself, you know, what did you take with you into that slate? What did your research process look like? What assumptions did you make, right? Did you fade a team because you thought they were going to be chalky? Separate that from the results of what fantasy points those players scored. Look at their ownership projections and see if you were right with that assumption, right? Did you fade a popular starting pitcher because you thought maybe he'd have a shorter leash than he did, right? Separate that from the results of what that fantasy points were actually scored there and see, you know, look at the pitch count, that kind of thing. I think studying the assumptions that you take with you into your contest in terms of why you made certain decisions is a more powerful use of time than trying to study the actual scores and optimize for the highest actual scoring lineup from a past slate. So I frankly, I know we have the review mode toggle. I just don't use it that often. It hasn't been too useful for me in my particular process. So, Brad said, Jordan placed a comment and question in support. I can take a look at it. It looks like Ruben's looking into this here. I can follow up with the support teams here and see what's going on there. I am not too sure actually. But I will make sure that somebody gets back to you there. Eric said, Jordan, will we ever be allowed to set exposure for teams before we build? Sometimes the builder doesn't give me the teams and percentage of exposure I want in MLB. Yes. That is something that we are talking about adding in the future. That is on our radar, a pretty common request. One thing I think you can do if you are finding that after a test build, you're not getting exposure to teams that you want, right? Let's jump back over to today's slate. I find making a half run adjustment in either direction can be really helpful to getting the build to look a little bit more like what you want it to do. Maybe we're looking at, maybe we want a little bit less Coors, right? A half run, even do a whole run, depending on the game situation. But maybe we want to knock down Coors a little bit. Maybe we're a little bit higher on the Dodgers, right? And maybe we want Angels. And I'm kind of just making this up here. Maybe a little bit lower on the White Sox, and lower on the Yankees. And we want more exposure to Astros and Red Sox, right? Making these adjustments here will sort through our game simulations and basically trim off game simulations until the mean team total for each of these teams actually matches what you've set it to here, and then running another build. While that will not necessarily match your exposure to these teams exactly the way that you want right off the bat, that should help with building a lineup pool that is much more functional for what you're actually trying to do here in the build screen. So we'll let this build for a second here because I actually want to show you all the way down to the end of this here. But it typically will help build a better pool of lineups. And I think good rule of thumb too, doing anything in SaberSim, using all of the tools at your disposal. Step three's the build screen is great, very helpful for fine tuning and dialing in. But if that pool of lineups isn't serving you, if that doesn't take the angle that you're looking for on the slate, head back to the home screen, make some adjustments there, and then start with another build. So let's see. I'm curious kind of what we get out of this here. So in this case, a ton of Houston all of a sudden popping. So maybe we need to cool off some of that Houston exposure. But now fading Coors, fading the Yankees, we're getting exposure to Houston. Not a lot of Boston, so maybe we want to force a little bit of Boston back in there. I'm trying to think about the other teams I bumped up, right? LA was another team. Maybe we want, 20% LA here. And the build should be a lot more flexible to these changes now since we made some of those adjustments on the home screen. But yes, it is our goal to add min and max exposures for team stacks up front in the future. So good question there. Glenn said, I've been hand building for a few years, so this shift in thinking is huge. I'm not tweaking much, but I did cap exposure at 80% for all individual players. Is this too much? It depends a lot on how many lineups you're playing, right? 80% exposure means something very different if you're playing 20 lineups versus if you're playing 150 lineups. I have no problem adjusting your exposures to manage your own risk on these players at all, right? I think that's a great idea. That's, I think, one of the best uses of your time here in step three or in the build screen, right? Is think about these, especially as you're pivoting from hand building maybe just a couple lineups to doing a little bit more multi-entry stuff, right? Think about these players as like assets in this portfolio that you have for the slate, right? And everybody's personal risk tolerance of how risky or how risk averse they want to be with their portfolio for a slate is going to be different, right? I personally, a lot of times, am playing up to 150 lineups, and I often don't want more than 40%, 30% of any hitter. Right, I don't think there's anything wrong with capping your exposure at 80% for hitters. For pitchers, a lot of times I will cap exposures or start to manage my exposures as soon as I'm up over 2 to 3x of the player's projected ownership. Right, I might feel like I can get enough leverage over the field on Talon here with 50% max exposure and do something like that. But I think overall, thinking about each player as right, like if you're playing, let's say you're playing the $4.20 max, right? You are investing $60 of your portfolio on that slate into Talon here by default, right? How much of that portfolio are you comfortable investing? The nice thing about doing this with SaberSim is that you've got a pool of lineups that is already optimized, that is already viable for that particular contest. So you can do this somewhat freely. If you're building with a traditional optimizer, right? You know, I guess even by hand, you kind of have to make your own assumptions of what exposure is appropriate for each individual player. With SaberSim, you've got a viable pool of lineups to work from. So adjusting your exposures to individual players until you're satisfied with the level of risk associated with that, you can do that in a way that's pretty safe because of the way that this portfolio works. So all that to say, I think that's a great idea. And I would not be concerned at all by adjusting capping exposure to 80%. I have no problem with that, especially in a sport like baseball. So, cool. Glenn said, okay, I've been hand building for 2 years with moderate success, huge shift in thinking, but I've learned a ton very quickly. Thanks. I'll keep my bankroll in check. Yeah, that is the right way to think about it. So, and, you know, I mean, speaking of realizing your equity more quickly, right? I should have mentioned this before. Not even just, you know, playing a little bit smaller contests can help you realize that a little bit more quickly. But the more lineups you are getting in play, the more opportunities you will to realize if your process is working or not as well. Because you're increasing that sample size much more quickly. You know, building, I would say it's really difficult, really, to know if you're just building a single lineup every night if you're actually doing anything right without using heuristics like roster construction heuristics and things like that. Because you're even by the end of the season, right? You've only really taken 100-150 shots at it, right? If you're playing 150 lineups, you can get 150 lineups, you can get 150 shots at that per slate, right? You get a lot more opportunity to realize if those lineups are actually good. Using things like top 1% equity can be a lot more of a valuable tool at that point. So, but Aaron said, I love the idea of fading or overweighing chalk. Yeah. I mean, especially in baseball, right? I mean, we can see that here just by pulling up the distributions of these players. We're going to get a giant stack here that's probably going to be between 20 and 30% owned here again tonight. You know, let's pull up after this loads here, let's pull up these distributions and look at some of these guys, right? Brandon Belt, 36% projected owned at the moment. Almost 50% of his outcomes under 5 points, right? Pretty consistent trend here with these hitters, right? We can go down and find Rafael D. Actually, Jordan Alvarez, even better, right? Projected for 2 points less at 5% ownership, very similar outcome curve. So yeah, I love the idea of being pretty aggressive with fading chalk in baseball as well. So looks like we got a free bet from Ryan here. Jaylen Brown over 5.5 rebounds -115. What do we have him at? Let's see. Do the Sims like it? Where is he? Sims have him at 572. It's probably pretty close. I don't know if that beats laying 115. It's close. But we will post a free, I at least assume so, we will post a free prop bet from our simulations, profitable NBA prop bet for tonight's game sometime tonight in the Slack community. So if you haven't already joined our Slack community, there's a link to join in the description of every past Office Hours stream. There will be a link to join in the description of this video as soon as this is up as a recording on YouTube as well. Aaron said, on small slates like that, I want 100% White Sox, but faded them in a single entry. Yeah, interesting. I had a lot of White Sox as well, I think, on this early slate. I think that if you wanted to play the most aggressive ownership game, I think that the Royals were probably pretty interesting on this early slate here. Leveraging directly against Cease, who probably is very chalky. I haven't had a chance to see how ownership all broke out. I don't even know what's going on in these games. The funny thing about doing these early streams here is sometimes I'll be talking about the games that are in progress with no real knowledge of what's actually going on in the game here. But I think that was probably one of the more interesting ownership plays there. So, and not even a really bad projected team in the Sims here was Kansas City, right? On a six team slate, three game slate, the fourth highest projected team, probably getting them at like zero ownership because of the pitcher that they're playing against is so popular. So Aaron said, I like using my single entry as leverage, and that's what I did with KC. Yeah, I do think it can be a little bit easier to like take direct leverage opportunities like that when you're playing fewer entries. I threw a single bullet into the FanDuel qualifier last night. I think it overlaid a little bit. It was like a $15 live final qualifier and stacked up the Braves, which didn't work out so much. But I played Severino and the Braves and Blue Jays. Just a little bit easier to find those like direct leverage situations against the chalk when you're playing a smaller another number of lineups. But Jonathan said, anyone like the method of first basket market for NBA? I'm not sure how beatable those are. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts if you've got you've got a little bit of an edge there. I think those are that feels like true gambling to me. Nothing wrong with that. But I don't know. I'm not sure if there's a easy way to be plus EV in first basket markets, unless you're like, I don't know, beating the books to news or something like that, like injury news, something along those lines, or starting lineup news or something like that. But I'm willing to have my mind changed on that. So, but Jonathan said, good to hear. It's not beatable. Maybe I missed a joke here. It's hard to read into context on the YouTube chat sometimes. But cool. HC said he faded Dodgers. Pray for my soul. We will see. Not really a wrong way to go on a three game slate, if you ask me. I think there's a lot of different ways to be successful. So, any other questions here for me today? I don't see any other questions or chats coming in here at the moment. A couple updates on the SaberSim side here. We are expecting to have an update to the front end of the app here, hopefully coming out this week. Will include some changes. I've teased this a couple times on stream here, but it'll include some changes to the entry editor and late swap workflow. Hopefully make that a little bit more streamlined. Comes along with some new feature updates to editing your exposures and projections, as well as some updates to Quick Swap. So excited about that. I am hoping that on Thursday here, Thursday's office hours stream, I will be able to come on and show off some of those new features on the live version of the app and do a little bit of a product demo on Thursday. So look forward to Thursday's stream. But HD said, who do you like for tonight's game, Boston or Miami? I don't really know. I don't feel like people are giving the Heat credit. I am curious, what is... Go over to Labs and see what the line it looks like here. Let's see. So, okay, so Vegas is favoring the Heat in this game. Interesting. I like the Heat. I think I like the Heat in the series. I don't think they're getting enough credit here. So I don't know. And maybe I'm wrong about that, because Vegas clearly is favoring the Heat as well. But it just seems like the narrative that you get out there is that Boston already has won this series. And I think the Heat are a good team. I think they're strangely a little bit, maybe even underrated at this particular point in the season. So tonight, give me the Heat. Ryan said he got Boston plus 2.5. Maybe we just middle it perfect there. So, but I think Boston is definitely the trendy pick. But I unfortunately, you know, I haven't been able to watch as much playoff basketball as I would have liked this year. It is my favorite sport to watch. I normally watch the playoff season pretty religiously, and I haven't been able to see as many games as I would have liked this time of the year. I've got a pending move here, so jumping through all the hoops that it takes to move this summer. So anyway, I don't see any other questions coming in. We'll go ahead and wrap up the stream here for today on that note. I will be right back here again tomorrow, same time, same place, 2 p.m. Eastern. If you haven't yet signed up for SaberSim, we have a free 7-day trial on our site, sabersim.com. Come check us out. Free 7 days, no strings attached. And look forward to that Thursday stream, where I am hoping to come on here, if everything goes to plan, and demo some of the new features. You will have the opportunity to play with some of them yourself Thursday morning as well, if we are on track here for that release. So as a last note, Brad said, do you guys do anything for college football? It is our goal to have college football sims for this season. I cannot promise that they will be ready for the start of the season, but it is our goal to support college football with simulations, same way we do everything else for this year. So looking forward to that. I'm hoping to dive into the college football DFS streets a little bit more this season, because I haven't played too much of that there either. So hopefully this year. But anyway, good luck tonight. Enjoy the game, and I will see you guys all tomorrow. Take care.